From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we meet one of the pioneers of stop-time animation, Ray Harryhausen. After getting his start on the film Mighty Joe Young, he gave life to the creatures and prehistoric beasts in such films as The Seventh Voyage of Sinbad, Jason and the Argonauts, and The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms. Before MTV's The Real World or The Osbournes, before the reality television craze, documentary filmmakers Susan and Alan Raymond chronicled the lives of the Loud family in their groundbreaking 1973 series, An American Family. We'll talk with the Raymonds about that series and about their new PBS documentary, which is about the death of Lance Loud. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush defended his new economic stimulus plan from critics today, even though he won't actually release the plan's specifics until tomorrow's meeting of the Economic Club of Chicago. NPR's Don Gagne reports from the White House.
Many of the details of the president's plan have leaked out over the past several days, including a proposal to eliminate taxes on dividends corporations pay to shareholders. Critics say that's another example of the Bush administration designing a policy that benefits wealthy Americans. The president, following a cabinet meeting at the White House, said it's simply not fair to tax dividends because the same money is taxed twice.
And in dividends, we tax the corporate profit, and then we tax the money being sent to the shareholder. That doesn't make any sense. That's unfair. That's bad public policy.
The president is also expected to propose tax cuts for small businesses, an extension of unemployment benefits that expired just after Christmas, and for tax cuts passed in 2001 but not yet in effect to be phased in more quickly. Don Gagne, NPR News, the White House.
More U.S. troops headed for the Persian Gulf region today, ready to be on station if President Bush decides to attack Iraq. The Navy hospital ship Comfort left Baltimore this morning on its way to duty at Diego Garcia Island in the Indian Ocean. The Comfort has 1,000 hospital beds, a dozen operating rooms, and facilities to treat soldiers who are injured by chemical or biological weapons. Meanwhile, ships carrying more than 4,000 Marines and sailors left San Diego today for a 6-month deployment in the Persian Gulf. More than 10,000 troops from the Army's 3rd Infantry Division were preparing to leave their bases in Georgia today on their way to Kuwait. In a speech to his nation today, Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein accused United Nations inspectors of spying. He also declared that Iraq is ready for war. NPR's Kate Seeley reports from Beirut.
In his televised message marking Army Day, Saddam issued his first public criticism of the current UN inspections. He said arms experts weren't doing their job of searching for alleged weapons of mass destruction. Instead, said Saddam, they were compiling lists of Iraqi scientists, asking workers misleading questions, and gathering information about legitimate military activities. These things, he said, are, quote, pure intelligence work. Despite his defiant tone, however, Saddam did not say Iraq would stop cooperating with the UN. Meanwhile, arms monitors searched at least 4 suspect sites today, including a pesticide factory north of Baghdad. Yesterday, monitors carried out a record 16 inspections. Kate Seeley, NPR News, Beirut.
In stocks today, the Dow gained 172 points to close at 8,773. The Nasdaq gained 34. It closed at 1,421. This is NPR News. Israel imposed more restrictions on the Palestinians today in response to yesterday's suicide attacks that left 22 people dead and more than 100 wounded in Tel Aviv. The Israeli government refused to allow a Palestinian delegation to travel to London for a conference on Middle East peace and Palestinian reforms. Israeli Foreign Secretary Benjamin Netanyahu refused an appeal from Britain to reconsider that ban. Netanyahu said the Palestinians were attempting to deceive the world with mock reforms. Israel also closed 3 Palestinian universities. A former U.S. Forest Service worker has agreed to plead guilty to a single state charge of fourth-degree arson for starting the biggest wildfire in Colorado history. Mark Roberts reports from Denver.
After the guilty plea, Terry Barton left the Teller County Courthouse in Cripple Creek without making any statement. Prosecutor Jeannie Smith says she brought the state charge because the Hayman fire hurt so many people, some who lost their livelihoods, their dreams. The fire, which started in June and burned through mid-July, blackened 138,000 acres, destroyed 133 homes, and cost more than $29 million to fight. Barton could spend 12 years in prison on the state charge. She's already agreed to a plea bargain on federal charges with a 6-year sentence. But both sentences would run concurrently. Barton faces a February 21st sentencing date on the federal charges and a March 5th sentencing date on the state charge. For NPR News, I'm Mark Roberts in Denver.
Santa Ana winds are driving a brush fire in Southern California. Hundreds of firefighters have been deployed to keep the 100-acre fire from reaching a row of expensive houses along the coast at Malibu. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Annie E. Casey Foundation, helping disadvantaged children and their families connect to strong and supportive neighborhoods, on the web at aecf.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Ray Harryhausen, gave life to the creatures and prehistoric beasts in such films as Jason and the Argonauts, The Seventh Voyage of Sinbad, The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms, It Came from Beneath the Sea, and Clash of the Titans. He's one of the masters of stop-motion animation. A restaurant is named after Harryhausen in the recent animated film Monsters Incorporated. A short children's film that he started 50 years ago was recently completed by two young animators who we'll meet a little later. That film will be shown this month at the Sundance Film Festival, and it's been nominated for an animation award known as the Annie. Harryhausen fell in love with stop-motion animation when in 1933, at the age of 13, he saw the movie King Kong. That ape was brought to life with stop-motion animation by Willis O'Brien. Harryhausen's first feature film was animating another ape, Mighty Joe Young, under the supervision of O'Brien. I asked Harryhausen to describe the models he used for Mighty Joe Young.
Yes, Mighty Joe Young, we had four large models, which were about 15, 16 inches high. And then we had a medium-sized model about 8 inches high, and then a small one about 3 inches high for very long shots. And they were all used for, depending on the size of the picture, whether it was a long shot or a close-up.
So how do you get that small model to look like a giant ape in the scene?
Well, it's all by comparison, size comparison. Of course, you have to have humans, just as in the film 1 Million B.C., we had to have humans with dinosaurs, although they never lived in that period. But you have no comparison unless you have something that everybody is familiar with.
And then you kind of match them after the fact? You put them in the same scene after the fact? They're shot separately?
Yes, sometimes they're optically put in through a process, a technical process called traveling mat. Otherwise, they're put in through a process called rear projection, miniature rear projection, which was the basis of most of Mighty Joe.
So explain how stop-time animation works.
Stop-motion animation is very similar to the cartoon. You have progressive drawings. Each drawing is a little more progressive than the previous drawing. But instead of using a flat drawing, you use a three-dimensional model that has ball and socket joints made of metal. And then when the shutter is closed on the camera, you go up and move it. You move the head, you move the eyes. You have to keep all the movements in synchronization. Then you step out of the frame and shoot one frame of motion picture film. There are 16 frames to the foot on 35 millimeter. So that it's the same basic principle as the cartoon, only you're using a three-dimensional model.
And you know, when you see the actual model moving, like when you see Mighty Joe Young moving or one of the dinosaurs that you've created, it has an almost otherworldly effect to it because it's moving, it looks real, and yet there's this almost like rippling kind of effect that makes it seem otherworldly. Does that work for you? Do you like that effect, that otherworldly
effect?
I
think that effect works beautifully for fantasy films because you're not trying to make a documentary. And one of the great advantages I've always felt of stop-motion animation is that it gives the illusion of a dream world. in a dream, a nightmare. You know it's not real, and yet it looks real. And I think stop motion adds to that, where if you try to make in a fantasy film it too real, you lose the element of the fantasy.
And what is it about stop-time animation that makes, say, Mighty Joe Young more convincing than a guy in an ape suit?
A man in a gorilla suit is obviously a man. I mean, the proportions are all wrong. And in a model animation such as stop-motion, you can create the anatomy to look more like a real gorilla. Then a man has shorter arms than a gorilla, and he has to lengthen them by some mechanical means. But in the early days, where they made films like Ngagi and White Pongo, they used a man in a gorilla suit just because it's quicker. Stop-motion animation, of course, takes time.
Now, I should tell you, I grew up watching Mighty Joe Young over and over and over again. I grew up in New York, where they had a million-dollar movie, and they'd show one movie continuously all week, and the movie of the week was often Mighty Joe Young. So,
wonderful.
Yeah, so like a lot of New Yorkers, I know that movie awfully well. There's a scene where, you know, Mighty Joe Young is being hunted by people who think that he's evil and dangerous, and as he is driving with his human companions in a van, they pass a burning apartment building, and a young girl is on a high floor in this building, and Mighty Joe Young risks his life climbing through this burning building to rescue this young girl. How did you animate him getting up this burning building and then carrying, you know, this girl in his arm down the burning building?
Well, that was quite a complicated process. We, of course, shot the burning building at a very high speed as a separate piece of film. And then it was composited in the camera through a process of rear projection. Many scenes were done in that fashion. We shoot the burning building. The burning building was about 5-6 feet high. And then it was shot at 96 frames a second, which slows down the motion of the flame so that it looks a much bigger scale than it was. And then you take that and reduce it on a screen to the size to match the size of the gorilla. And then the girl many times was animated as well on his back. And the little child on the ledge was also animated many times, intercut with the live action.
Wow. So it must have been pretty exciting early in your career to work on this.
Well, this little girl on the ledge was only 3 inches high, and she was beautifully machined with the armature inside of her. And it was a pleasure to animate this little child struggling on the ledge, almost about to fall off.
If you're just joining us, my guest is the great animator Ray Harryhausen, master of stop-motion animation. The first feature that you were the chief animator for was The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms. I want you to describe The Beast.
The Beast was a composite animal. He was sort of a bit of a brontosaurus mixed with an allosaurus mixed with a tyrannosaurus. We didn't want a known beast because it wouldn't fit the story, and it would be in competition with The Lost World, which had been made in the silent days. So we had a composite beast, which they named Redisaurus.
And the premise of the movie is that the beast, this like prehistoric beast, is brought back to life because of radiation from a nuclear bomb blast.
Yes, that was the period in history when no one quite knew what would happen with the radiation of atomic blast. So the beast was a product of the unknown. He was frozen in ice for millions of years, and when the atomic bomb exploded in the North Pole, he was freed.
Was this one of the first monster, like post-nuclear monster movies?
It was an early monster movie, yes. It was one of the first. The next picture we made, It Came from Beneath the Sea, had the same basic premise, that you didn't know what would happen if the atomic bomb was exploded underwater.
And what and happened?
It produced this giant octopus that pulled down the Golden Gate Bridge.
So
that period, of course, destructed anything that had destruction, and it was very popular at that time.
Now, I understand the city of San Francisco wasn't wild about the idea of destroying the Golden Gate Bridge, and they didn't want you to shoot on location. Obviously, you weren't going to destroy the bridge for real, but would you remember what the negotiations were like with the city over...
Well, I think it was the city fathers who felt that people would lose confidence in the structure if they saw that the bridge could be destroyed by an octopus, even though it was a giant octopus. But we overcame that, of course, by putting cameras in a bakery truck, and secretly we shot the scenes we found necessary to use in the film.
Do you have a favorite monster, Ray Harryhausen?
I try not to have, because the others get jealous.
Oh, and boy, you don't want to be around when those monsters get jealous.
No, not when they're in that room. No, my favorite monsters are the more complicated ones, like the Hydra had 7 heads, which you had to animate, and the 7 skeletons took a lot of time.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, Medusa in Clash of the Titans. She was a fascinating image to animate. I had to keep 12 snakes in her hair, all animated to be moving in harmony so that with the rest of the body, besides giving her a bow and arrow and a rattlesnake's tail. So these more complicated images I find much more interesting to animate than the simple, normal figure, I suppose you'd call it.
You know, so many of your monsters are based on, you know, dinosaurs and giant lizards. Are there certain real lizards or insects or animals that you studied closely and based some of your creations on?
Well, yes, I do a lot of research when I create a creature. I like to make them logical. That's my theory, is that if you make them too extreme, too exaggerated, you lose your audience, because they're just a grotesque piece of whatnot. You don't know quite what they are. So I try to keep them within harmony of something they've seen. For example, dinosaurs, you couldn't possibly photograph them in reality. So we had to create them artificially. Elephants, for example, you would study an elephant as to how a dinosaur might move. You'd study a lizard, a crocodile, or a monitor lizard to try to get the reptilian feel to the dinosaur. Not to copy them. You always have to glamorize, I think, when you're making a film. That's an ugly word sometimes in today's market. But I try to glamorize the movements. I tried to glamorize the creatures, not make them just exactly the way they may have been in the early days, but photographically so they would look the part that they're supposed to play in the picture.
Have you seen Jurassic Park? And I'm wondering...
Yes.
What do you think of the monsters and the dinosaurs in Jurassic Park?
Oh, they're marvelous. I think the CGI is a remarkable advance in entertainment. But I don't think it's a be-all and buy-all. I think there's room for every media, depending on the story you want to tell. Kermit the Frog, Jim Henson brought back the hand puppet that goes back to ancient Greece and made it suitable for entertainment. And Thunderbirds, of course, is very popular with the string marionettes. And I've always maintained that the miraculous image, when we made pictures in the 50s, the miraculous image was rare. You didn't very often see unusual images such as the Cyclops or the dragon on the screen at that time. But today we're inundated. In a 30-second commercial, you see the most amazing images. So the miraculous is no longer miraculous.
My guest is stop-motion animator Ray Harryhausen. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is stop-motion animator Ray Harryhausen. His films include Jason and the Argonauts, The Seventh Voyage of Sinbad, and The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms. There's an animation that you started 50 years ago, The Tortoise and the Hare, that's just been completed with the help of two young animators who are also your fans. And they're actually in the studio with you, and they're going to join our conversation now. They're Seamus Walsh and Mark Caballero, and they've done animations for the Cartoon Network, The Simpsons, and MTV. Ray Harryhausen, did you work with them on completing it, or did you just leave it to them?
No, I worked with them as much as we could. I tried to find the story. I shot 4 minutes of animation in the 50s, and then, of course, monsters were more lucrative financially, so I felt somehow, with all the moves we've made in the various houses we've occupied, I lost the story continuity, so I had to start from scratch. So I made a new continuity and set designs for them, and then we met several times, and they contributed enormously to it and contributed to the storyboards. So it was sort of a group finishing project.
Did you have the original models for The Tortoise and the Hare?
Yes, the original models were 50 years old, and fortunately I'd kept them in fairly good condition.
Did they have arthritis or anything? I mean, were they still functioning?
Rigor mortis didn't set in yet, no. They were very workable, and Mark often said that it was a pleasure to animate them. They were made by my father, by the way, way back in the late 40s and early 50s. And my mother dressed them, made the costumes, and they were still good, and they hadn't faded. They did a bit of touching up. I think they remade the gloves and a few other minor things, and remade the tortoise because, unfortunately, the tortoise was lost. I had a set of heads for the tortoise, but no body. So they, based on the drawings and the photographs of the original, they reproduced the tortoise.
Mark and Seamus, you've come of age in an era of computer-generated imagery, but you use stop-motion animation in your own work. Why use stop-motion animation when you could use, like, digital effects of various kinds?
You know, it probably goes back to when we both grew up separately as kids, but it kind of goes back to when we were kids. I know I can say it for myself, and I know Seamus well enough to say the same thing. Watching the shows, you know, up in the big screen with the stop motion and knowing that it's animation, but not really quite understanding how it all works, that it is real. And that definitely influenced us into wanting to do it ourselves, because there's a whole tangibility aspect of these models that we get to animate and you know, imbue life into, so to speak, and you have a complete control over your entire set. And Ray calls it a Frankenstein complex
or a Zeus complex
and it feels so much, I don't know, I feel like I can put in so much more emotion and energy into a dimensional object rather than having to have to create it on a computer screen or draw it. And I'm not the best at drawing consecutive images at the same time.
Well, computer animation requires a great many people, doesn't it?
It does.
You each person does a separate thing. It's more a conglomerate. It's more it's less of a one-man point of view. I think that makes a difference too, don't you?
Yeah, I think so. It is appealing, the fact that you don't have to have a giant crew of people working on this, each handling a separate task of a character. What you got on film as you've shot is what you get. And the next morning when you see that up on the screen, it's pretty exciting because you know that you actually did the whole thing yourself.
You control the entire scene that you just shot. And even though nowadays they're done with CG or animation, like cell animation, where there's a lead animator in control of the entire process, there's a lot of points where that lead animator doesn't actually animate that character. And when you're doing stop motion, you're pretty much controlling the whole character throughout the whole thing. So you're carrying that same emotion and personality within you, and you're bringing it onto your character at all times.
Ray Harryhausen grew up watching King Kong and Frankenstein and those early monster and horror movies. Mark and Seamus, I'm interested, what monster movies or cartoons did you grow up watching that made the biggest impression?
Well, I was lucky enough to have cool parents that showed me Ray's films and King Kong, even though they were old by the time I was a child. And I was just immediately fascinated by Seventh Voyage of Sinbad and King Kong. But I also really loved the Rankin-Bass holiday specials, like Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, because they were all done using the same technique. They were just different uses of the same technique.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that Mark would probably say the same thing.
Pretty much the same thing. I did have the nightmares of Ray's collie coming in and attacking, or the Cyclops, or even, you know, on the Rankin-Bass stuff. All that stuff was tremendous. Yeah,
that
tremendous
abominable
influence.
Snowman scared me.
Ray Harryhausen, how do you feel hearing that your Cyclops followed Mark into his nightmares?
Well, it's quite exciting that Willis O'Brien's work impressed me so, and the snowball keeps rolling on and getting bigger and bigger. And now my work has impressed other people. So I'm most grateful that our films have affected people more than just an hour of entertainment. When I go to these conventions, I have a family of three generations come up and say, "You made my childhood. Your films changed my career." Two professors in Canada said that if it hadn't been for 1 million BC and Guanji, they wouldn't be paleontologists. So
I hope they weren't expecting to find Raquel Welch in their studies.
No, well, that's a theater that you have to. That again is glamorization of a film. But so I'm grateful that this snowball is rolling on. Who knows what will come from Mark and Seamus in the future?
Well, Ray Harryhausen, Seamus Walsh, Mark Caballero, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having us.
Thank you.
Ray Harryhausen's films include Jason and the Argonauts, The Seventh Voyage of Sinbad, and The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms. Mark Caballero and Seamus Walsh completed Harryhausen's animated short, The Tortoise and the Hare. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by FindLaw, offering an online directory of more than 1 million attorneys, plus consumer and business legal guides, providing a place to find answers, find lawyers, find law, findlaw.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, putting the life of a real American family on TV decades before the current reality TV craze. We talk with filmmakers Susan and Alan Raymond. Their 1973 PBS documentary series chronicled the lives of the Loud family. Their new documentary is about the death of Lance Loud. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Decades before the reality television craze, my guests, Susan and Alan Raymond, brought the life of a real American family to television. In 1973, their 12-part public television series, An American Family, showed the day-to-day life of Bill and Pat Loud and their children, Lance, Grant, Kevin, Delilah, and Michelle. TV viewers watched the marriage break up and watched Lance live an unconventional life as a young gay man, inspired by Andy Warhol and his crowd. Tonight, most public television stations will show a new documentary by the Raymonds about the death of Lance Loud. He died in December of 2001, at the age of 50, of liver failure caused by hepatitis C and HIV. Here's a clip in which Lance Loud is explaining why he invited the Raymonds to make a film about his final days.
It just came into my mind, and I thought, I can't leave the planet without some form of closure from the series. Because I didn't think that the series, when last seen in the series, we were a desperate group. My parents were divorcing. I was heading towards drugs and slow destruction. Everyone was cut off from each other. And that's not the case of what it has become. I mean, we're still together. We still love each other very, very much. I want a happily ever after, and if it can't be mine, it'll be someone in my family's.
After tonight's broadcast of Lance Loud, A Death in an American Family, public TV stations will show the second episode of the 1973 Loud Family series, in which Lance's mother visited him in New York, where he took her to see a performance by drag queens from Warhol's crowd. Here's Lance and his mother having dinner after the performance.
Oh, some of the one-liners were so good, I couldn't believe it. Candy darling.
I don't like things that make me feel uncomfortable and embarrassed, and it did.
Well, no, I just thought of it as a variety show, you know?
Yeah,
a transvestite variety show.
That's really what it is.
Well, it was certainly a grand entrance into New York, I want to tell you.
I know, what a day this has been.
I spoke with documentary filmmakers Alan and Susan Raymond about their series on the Loud family and their new film about Lance Loud. In this era of reality television, with shows like The Osbournes and The Anna Nicole Smith Show, I think it's very interesting to look back on An American Family, you know, which premiered in 1973, and talk a little bit about what went into that. How was the Loud family chosen as the family to build this reality series around?
Well, none of us knew it was going to be a series, for starters. Everybody, including the Louds and us, thought it was going to be an hour, and it just kept growing and growing and growing until we eventually lived with the family for 7 months daily. So it was a very intense experience for us. And producer of the series chose the family, and he was a New Yorker who wanted a California family. He was very specific about that. Took him a long time to find a family, and eventually this was his selection. And
we should say we weren't involved in the selection of the Louds. Mm-hmm. The original producer of the series, Craig Gilbert, picked them. It's always been a kind of open question as to what extent he was aware of any marital problems. We're of the opinion that he may have suspected them, and that could have been part of his reason for selecting the Louds. I'm not sure that he knew Lance was gay, because Lance was living in New York at the time he met with the family in Santa Barbara. I think he knew that he was living in New York at the Chelsea Hotel, so he might have suspected something in the way of a counterculture lifestyle. But when we started filming, the actual first day's filming of the series was in New York City at the Chelsea Hotel when Pat showed up to, you know, start that week's visit.
First roll of film was Lance on the phone in his room with all those people swarming around, and then we went down to the curb and met Pat on camera and just followed them for that week. So Pat and Lance were just thrown into it with cameras walking through the door. That was it.
So the producer who chose the Loud family for the series didn't necessarily know that Lance was gay. Did Lance's parents know that he was gay?
I'm pretty confident they did.
It's always been to us a kind of complex question as to what extent episode two, the episode in which Pat visits him in New York City, was an opportunity for Lance to demonstrate his gayness more openly.
I should say, in this
mother.
Episode, they go to they're hanging around with a lot of the Warhol crowd. They go to a performance of Warhol people, a performance mostly by transvestites. So,
right, her first night in New York City, he takes her to see Vain Victory, a Jackie Curtis play with Candy Darling and people like that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's sort of throwing her, you know, into the fire, as it were, in terms of, you know, his lifestyle. Obviously, in the film, Pat says that, you know, she was aware he was gay at an earlier age and that the family accepted him. And I think that that's certainly credible. The degree to which he, you know, used the camera in episode two to kind of confront her a little bit more with that, I think is a little more open question.
That's Lance. You see, I don't think Pat was shocked. I think America was shocked. I think that's where the series became so controversial and so riveting, because America was seeing things that they hadn't seen on mainstream television before. Lance had had this childhood relationship with Andy Warhol. He wrote letters to Andy. Andy wrote back. They had telephone conversations. So when he finally got old enough to get to New York and live his and start his life, he wanted to go where Andy had went. So there he was in the Chelsea Hotel. He thought he was in Chelsea Girls too. So that's where that young man's mind was speeding forth, you know, as he was going to live that life. And then Mom came to see what he was doing. And I don't know if she was that shocked. I think America was.
Did you have any ground rules for what was fair to shoot, what was off limits to shoot? If they said, this is a private moment, please remove the cameras, would you agree to that?
They didn't usually deal with it in that manner. Usually they would just simply be evasive. In other words, people would say, well, Bill, for example, we'd be sitting around Bill's office and he'd say, excuse me, I have to run to the bank, you know, to make a deposit. And in fact, he was getting his car and driving to Los Angeles for a week. And so, you know, 2 hours later, we'd realize he had sort of, you know, left. But no, there was really no preconditions, no understandings of any kind that certain things were off limit. I mean, we pretty much wandered around the house, stuck our noses in, you know, every
bedrooms,
room.
Bedrooms, bathrooms, garage bands.
And I think, you know, the famous scene in episode 9 in which Bill comes home from a business trip and Pat at that point asks him for a divorce. And then there's a kind of you know, confrontation between the two of them, and he eventually, you know, walks out of the house and leaves. And, you know, the camera goes down the hallway, and, you know, have a shot of Pat in the bedroom sort of crying and Bill kind of going out the door in this angry way. I mean, they didn't really, you would have thought, you know, at a moment like that, they might have said, okay, this has gone too far, this experiment. You know, we have to stop at this point. But they didn't.
And we examined that when we made our film in 1983 to ask them about that night. And they all, five of them, had different perspectives on what happened. And I remember one comment about Bill, who didn't understand what was about to happen to him, because Pat had sent Grant to the airport and Grant was supposed to tell him, and Grant couldn't tell him, so he didn't give him any clue. And he came home and he said, well, and I pulled up in the driveway and the lights are on and the camera crew's in the house and everything was just normal. So that's the way their life was. We were part of their life. It was normal to have those lights on. It was normal for us to be walking around from room to room to room.
Normal because they became acclimated to you. But
And that was many months into the filmmaking. So
yeah,
that,
right.
I mean, I think
that
it's important to understand that, you know, unlike some documentary or many documentary films which are made over a relatively short production schedule, that kind of daily routine that we became part of, I think, allowed us to kind of go much deeper into their intimate lives than probably, you know, many documentary, you know, filmmakers would get just by showing up for a few weeks or something
but
like
I
that.
But I also think that after they started living with the camera, I mean, their arc of naivete changed. And I think Pat used the camera that evening because the camera gave her strength to do it, to speak to him, to confront him publicly rather than privately, because she wanted a witness, literally. And I think that's why she did it. Because that, when he says in 1983, who's to say what would have happened if you weren't there? What would that discussion have been like if we hadn't been there? But they didn't throw us out. And Pat, I think, wanted us to be there that night.
My guests are Susan and Alan Raymond. Their new film about the death of Lance Loud will be shown tonight on many public TV stations, followed by an episode of their 1973 documentary series on the Loud family. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are documentary filmmakers Alan and Susan Raymond. They made the groundbreaking 1973 series, An American Family, a 12-part documentary series about the Loud family. Their new documentary about the death of Lance Loud will be shown tonight on many public TV stations. When you were filming the Loud family at their most kind of private and devastating moments, like, for instance, when Pat asked Bill for a divorce, what sense of mission did you have in your mind that you were able to call upon to justify your presence there? I mean, most people don't feel comfortable when they're with close friends who are having a fight, let alone here you are filmmakers, you know, capturing the lives of people who had been strangers for you, knowing that you're going to be showing it to millions of people on television. So what was it that enabled you to justify that to yourselves as you were there?
Well, we did have a problem, and I was emotionally upset, and I remember Alan giving me a good shove on the back to get in that room, and at some point you had to realize, why were you there?
Alan, do you remember that moment that Susan just referred to when you kind of pushed her on the shoulder and said, come on, you got to get out there and film it?
Well, I think what happened was it was a kind of, you know, complex situation. As Susan said earlier, Pat had sent Grant, the youngest boy in the family, to pick Bill up at the airport. We had been on that business trip with Bill and had just returned.
We were in the back seat with Grant.
No, a day or so earlier than right. Bill had come back. So Grant was supposed to clue Bill in that he was coming home to this situation. He didn't do it. He didn't.
And we were with Grant meeting Bill at the airport.
Right. So then when we went back and we all came in the door and there was this sort of, you know, tension you could, you know, slice with a knife in the house, I don't think anybody really knew how it was going to play out. And Pat chose to sit in the living room to do it. And Bill kind of, you know, took his tie off and jacket off and put his suitcase down and sort of was wandering around. Eventually, you know, walked in the living room. And you know, I realized, as you know, the sound recording is an important part of cinema. You had to sort of get closer. So, you know, Susan was, and I was sort of standing on the edge of it. And, you know, I did have to kind of push her in.
Yeah, this is great, great, horrible moment where the cameraman decides to use his long zoom lens and the sound person's got to get in close. You know, they can hide in the hallway, but I got to get up close, you know.
But oddly enough, I mean, having said all that, they did, in fact, go through with the scene as if we weren't there. And I think, you know, as Bill said in 1983, and we used a bit of it in the Lance Loud film where he says, who's to say what would have happened if you had been there? I don't know. I mean, would he have gotten angry? As Susan suggested, did Pat feel protected in some way by the presence of the camera crew filming it, you know, or
but you know
verbally
what?
Abuser?
It seems to me that, you know, here's the Loud family kind of getting deeper and deeper into displaying their emotional lives on film for you. And as they're getting deeper and deeper into it, as they become more and more acclimated to your presence and to your camera and the sound equipment, it's not being broadcast yet. So they're getting deeper into it without having any sense of what it's actually going to be like once it hits television, once people actually see it. You know what I mean?
I think that's a very important point, that obviously you can act your life out in front of a camera, but as you just said, it's not, you know, it's not being beamed up to some satellite
exactly.
at that moment.
Exactly.
It's actually 2 years later almost
right.
before the show is broadcast.
Right. So I could see why it could be so easy for them to slowly get acclimated, let down their guard, but then, boom, a couple of years later, it's actually broadcast. People are watching all of this. What do you remember most vividly about the Loud family's reaction to the series when it was broadcast on public television in 73?
Well, Pat was horrified, and Lance loved it. And Bill just took it on the chin. Bill just took it, you know, rolled with the punches.
I mean, we should say, if some of your listeners aren't aware, there was a tremendous media explosion that followed the series. 10 million viewers a week watched it. And this was on PBS, which I very few shows get that kind of a rating. The family ended up on the cover of Newsweek with a banner across the cover saying "The Broken Family." They went on talk shows like the Dick Cavett Show, Donahue, those kind of things. And Pat Loud eventually wrote a book of her life story called Pat Loud, A Woman's Story. So there was a tremendous media explosion, but at the center of it essentially was a kind of, now I think we would think of it as a very cruel barrage of criticism leveled not at the series, but at the family's lifestyle. So I think it was very difficult for them to really look at the series with any kind of open mind at some point, because they were just responding to being called, you know, Shanna Alexander, Newsweek called them zombies, and A Glimpse into the Pit, Anne Royfe in a truly hateful article in the New York Times Magazine called Lance the evil flower of the family, and a Goya-esque emotional dwarf. I mean, these were very cruel, mean-spirited kinds of comments about, you know, their lives. So who could kind of take that kind of criticism? No one, I don't think.
Tell me if you would agree with this. It seems to me that because Lance Loud was one of the stars, so to speak, of An American Family, the real documentary about his family's life, it was easy for him to get a recording contract for his band, the Mumps, and to be in the limelight. On the other hand, it was probably more difficult for him to be taken seriously, because once he got his recording, a lot of people just dismissed the band like, oh, that's just the kid from the Louds. No wonder he has a record. It's because that TV series made him famous, but he doesn't have any talent.
Well, we should say that Lance, those who may not be aware of it, if you examine the New York City punk rock scene in the 1970s, Lance fronted a band called the Mumps that was actually a real band that played for many years at venues like CBGB's and Max's Kansas City. I actually would take exception to what you said, though, to the extent that I don't think they enjoyed any kind of recording career success. I think the fact that he was well known as an openly gay person actually hindered the success of the band, mm-hmm. to whatever degree the band had talent or not. And I think that they were kind of a fun band with Lance as a kind of funny frontman singer, and they had a dedicated following, but they didn't actually achieve much success, and the band actually fell apart after about 5 years, I think largely because people did feel that, as you suggested, he may have just been kind of, you know, using his media celebrityhood to...
But I think that's the value of the 30-year reflection and this last film, is that everyone wants to be famous now. Everybody even thinks they're entitled to it. Like, it should happen next week. I'm ready. And then this question really addresses the questions, okay, well, what are you going to do when it happens to you? How is it really going to affect you? Oh, yeah, you're going to parlay this into record contracts and book deals? Or is this going to haunt you for the rest of life? Are you going to be cast in a negative persona for the rest of your life that you're going to have to try to get out of? I mean, what does it mean to be for an ordinary person to be a celebrity?
What about the parents? What about Bill and Pat? How did they get cast, and how do you think it affected their lives to become famous?
I think that Pat tends to always believe that she's regretful of what happened. But on the other hand, she also had an entree into a certain world that was a great deal of fun. And she moved to New York and lived there for 10 years, and she became a literary agent and a publicist herself. And I think she enjoyed a certain cachet, for sure. I think Bill Loud was a very attractive man that women wanted to know after the series was over, now that he was a single divorcee. But then that all faded, you know. And I think that Bill had a strong enough ego that he just basically went on with his life, you know.
I think it's important to say that none of the family, with the the exception of Lance, really remembered the series fondly. I mean, I think they all kind of felt it was in some way this huge error in judgment, you know, to agree to be the subjects of the series, that even though they did get a certain media celebrityhood, in the end it kind of hurt the family. And I think that was part of what Lance tried to do with this last documentary we made with him, which was to kind of show that the family had kind of survived, that you know, they were loving. I think it was important to him to show that he had patched up his relationship, for example, with his father, who had always appeared in earlier episodes as being, you know, very judgmental of Lance's lifestyle. And you know, it's so hard to sort of talk about them in a way that would divorce them from that experience. I think that they just see it in largely negative terms.
My guests are Alan and Susan Raymond. Their new film is about the death of Lance Loud. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are documentary filmmakers Alan and Susan Raymond. They made the groundbreaking 1973 series An American Family, a 12-part documentary series about the Loud family. Their new documentary about the death of Lance Loud will be shown tonight on many public TV stations. I think the two main things you could expect to get out of a series, a reality series like An American Family, is one, fame, because assuming people tune in, that's going to happen. But the other is self-knowledge. If you were actually watching a playback of your life, you'd probably learn something about yourself. It may or may not be something that you're happy to have learned. Do you think that there was self-knowledge that came out of the series?
Well, we always find that showing the film to the subjects is the worst thing you can possibly do, because they can't judge mm-hmm. how they appear and look. But I think the real question is, what is the purpose of this film? Is this the purpose of this film to teach the Loud family how to become better parents or more loving siblings? No, that's not the purpose of the film. The purpose of the film is to reflect American family life. And that's was what they did do. And things changed in that decade because of American Family. You know, at the beginning of the decade, it was a scandal to have a divorce. At the end of that decade, the divorce rate has hit 50%, where it has stayed since the 70s. For some strange reason, it gave forth to all of these talk shows, these endless programs that come on, and everyone talks freely about intimate things just to be on TV. That didn't happen before 73. People came on talk shows to promote things. Now they're just, you know, endless programs on confessing intimacies. And also it also changed feature films. It had a huge, profound ripple effect into American culture.
Are there parts of this ripple effect that you're proud of and others that you're not so proud of?
Well, I think that, you know, like Frankenstein's monster, it's a mixed blessing to be considered, you know, someone who sort of spawned this reality TV genre. I mean, I think it's a sort of largely superficial, stupid genre of television programming that I don't think is, as a documentary filmmaker, I take much pride in. I also believe that although I think you could, you know, say there were controversial elements to An American Family and that, yes, maybe it was a quote-unquote reality TV series as we now think of them, it was also a serious documentary. You know, they weren't the real cast of the real world who had been brought together in some fabulous Soho loft to quibble over, you know, who ate the container of Haagen-Dazs last night. I mean, they were a real family living in their real homes, going through the throes of an important period in their lives. And so, no, I'm not in any way proud of any of the shows we begot. I mean, when I flip by the Annie Nicole show, I want to vomit to think that people actually think this is worth, you know, watching Anna go to the dentist and, oh, she doesn't like to have her teeth worked on. Who cares, you know? She's a superficial, stupid person who doesn't deserve this show. And it, all it becomes is a kind of voyeuristic exercise.
What are some of the things that you learned about filmmakers? And I'm thinking specifically that when you started shooting The Loud Family in their home, you were in some ways probably as inexperienced and naive as they were about what the real results of this were going to be once it hit TV. And you saw a surprising media backlash, a lot of criticism against The Louds. You saw The Louds be upset at the results of the broadcast and the reactions to it. So what are some of the things you learned about the impact that your movies could have on the lives of the people who are in those films?
I think it had a very large impact on our filmmaking approach. The good part was we learned how to make films. We shot 300 hours of footage. We perfected our cinema verite approach to filmmaking, and we realized that the bonding of the relationship between the filmmakers and the subject was extremely important. So I think that you see that in the rest of our films, whether it's Police Tapes or the children in the refugee camps that we're talking to. We are able to get people to be relaxed on camera and talk to us candidly. I think my reaction from American Family is I said I'll never do another film on the family. They can't handle this. This is too brutal. So we went off and made films on policemen or a warden or a principal of a school, people who were public officials who need to be examined and need to explain to us their role and their responsibility and have accountability. But we did not do anything on ordinary people or families. Mm-hmm. I didn't think that they could handle that kind of scrutiny.
Susan and Ellen Raymond, their new documentary, Lance Loud, A Death in an American Family, will be shown tonight on many public TV stations, followed by episode 2 of their 1973 documentary series on the Loud family. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with Lance Loud and his band, The Mumps.
Well, on the outside, I'm a pretty cool guy. I'm not good looking, but still I try. On the inside, well, I'm frustrations galore. I'm never happy. All I want is more. So can you teach me
what you want me to be?
Teach me what your reality is.
Tapes and transcripts of Fresh Air are available at 1-877-213-7374 or on the internet at www.burrells.com. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, screenwriter and novelist Richard Price, author of the bestseller Clockers. His new novel, Samaritan, is about a TV writer who returns to New Jersey to be with his daughter and to try to help the kids in the housing project where he grew up. But his efforts to do good backfire. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.